In this year, we've produced 48 shows, welcomed 24 guests, and got promoted to League One with the same old Wombles. We're back.
I've been standing here since many years ago. You've been under my skin for as long as I have known. We traveled away and we stand in the rain and the cold. Take the rough with the smooth. If we win or we lose, we just go.
Hello, dear listener. I'm Matt Cooper, and welcome to our special end of year review, looking back over 2025 with highlights from the podcast. I'm sure there will be some of you thinking this will be a very short show. Now, none of this podcast would be possible without the regular team of Niall Cooper talking about Fair Game, Adam Professor Dr. Proctor and his travel updates, and stats guru Tall Mark Lewis giving some shout outs. If you've listened to the same old Wombles, you'll know how often we hark back to the 1980s and 90s. So when John Scale joined us for our 100th episode, we had to get his reflection on that magic day in 1988.
Yeah, I came on. I think Vinny looked over and my arms went out, they were waiting for instructions. And it was I think Bobby just said, go on and make a nuisance of yourself, and chased out the centre backs up high up the pitch and go on up front. So, yeah, that was a bit of a shock, if I'm honest, but not bad to get on and play that half an hour and be part of that special day. But you're right, it was a phenomenal part of that moment in Wimbledon's history, and the whole preparation, the Cannizzaro the night before going to the game. It was weird because the whole thing sort of passed me by in many ways, because I'd been at the club. I'd joined the season before, that summer before in 87. I'd had that year. I got injured in the semi-final. I thought I'd missed the final. I was on the bench, and the relief to be part of the squad, not up in the stand. And then to get on, it was, it's sort of a surreal day in many ways. And one that we obviously just relish so much.
The 80s and 90s was a golden period for the same old Wombles crew. So we got a bit excited when we managed to get an inside view of what it was like at the club during that time, when we caught up with former goalkeeping apprentice Steve Mumford, who spoke about his time training alongside Hans Seegers and Neil Sullivan. And I just need, so you had Hans, and then you were then it was Sully. Is that right?
Yeah.
So how did they compare as keepers? And come on, tell us, who in your eyes, who was the better one?
Well, I thought they were both amazing, both brilliant goalkeepers in their own right. I mean, during my time, Hans was number one. I was just in awe of him because his techniques were second to none, and his kicking was brilliant. He was amazing. And I think probably after I finished at Wimbledon, I think Sully went on to prove he was an amazing goalkeeper, and he's very calm under pressure. He had a bit more height. Hans probably made things look a little better than Neil would, because he wouldn't have so far to spring. But I'd say during my time, I would have said Hans, but on the whole, I'd probably say they're 50-50, really. Both were amazing trainers. They'd be out there every day. I mean, Hans used to take us for personal training sessions with Phil Parks. Do you remember Phil Parks?
West Ham, yeah.
So we'd go down to Fleet, and this is me jumping in the car with my hero Hans, and he'd drive us down to Fleet, and we would have a session where it'd be me and the Wimbledon goalkeepers plus the QPR goalkeepers, and we'd just be playing keeper wars with each other, and Phil Parks would be teaching us certain things and techniques and mindset stuff and everything, so it was brilliant.
Even when we got a recent ex-player on, we managed to get them to chat about our Premier League days. Here's Mickey Haswell talking about his time as a ball boy at Wimbledon.
My first time being ball boy, we kind of all met up outside, and we got taken in, and we got taken into what I can only describe as a boardroom. And, at 9, 10 years of age, quite small, this boardroom, it felt massive. It probably wasn't, but it felt massive. And this mahogany table, leather chairs, and, you know, there's probably about 10 or 12 of us. And we kind of, you know, it was just huge. And all of a sudden, the door swung open, and this what seemed like a giant came rushing in. And lo and behold, it was Vinnie Jones. And I won't repeat what he said, but he was, you know, seething. He was shouting. He was screaming. And these 12 ball boys were petrified, absolutely petrified, you know, to the point where some of us are hiding behind chairs under the table. I mean, it lasted probably all of 15 seconds and it felt like 15 minutes. But that was my first flavour of Vinnie Jones at Sellers Park. And he did come back in a bit later to kind of smooth things over. And then when we were kind of getting ready to go out, we'd kind of walk through literally the dressing rooms and the tunnels. And those were the days when the music was absolutely blaring. And you'd kind of, you know, us young kids, some of us were kind of walking through hands over ears because the bass was just phenomenal. But
yeah, that'd be Philo.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of look back now and you think, wow. At the time, I think there was an element of fright and just sheer kind of petrified of the whole thing. But it was very enjoyable. And as I say, we got to do it several times. So I was very lucky in that sense.
Why was Vinnie Jones so upset? What had you done to him?
I think it's something that he did.
Oh, right.
I think, you know, he was always up for a laugh.
Oh, right. Just
wanting to cause fun and noise and, and whatever he could do. And I think he was quite renowned for kind of putting the fear in the ball boys. And then when he did come back, I remember this now, he would come back and then give you a few tips on what he wanted from you because he had the long throat.
Yeah.
So every ball boy would be given a towel, depending on the conditions, and he'd always say, make sure you do this, do that, and make sure the ball's dry when you give it to me, sort of thing.
Oh, yes, we did enjoy those times back in the Premier League, taking down the big boys. But we equally enjoyed those early days in the CCL. One player who summed up the early resurrection years was Captain Caveman himself, Matt Everard, who gave us the lowdown on our 78-match unbeaten record, a record that still remains to this day.
There is medal. You think? Well, you must do as well. You think you go to places where they're not built to have 200-300 people, let alone having 1,000 to 2,000 go to games. It was an insane time, and to be in that league for 2 years as well. That was the harder thing. Like not to go up. It was so tight. You had to have. I think there was 46 league games, and I think we maybe lost 4 or 5 in that first season.
It was 3, I think.
We ended with
something like 110 points or something ridiculous.
And came third. Did we come third?
Finished third.
Like, it's mad, isn't it? Like, and only lost 3 games. That is mad. One of them to Ash, by the way, as well.
Of course.
So obviously, I think the game that you lost was against Whitdean.
Yes, that was my second game. So the first game was Chesson and Hook away, the infamous white kits in the mud and the sand. That was my first game. Yeah, and then with Dean at home, we were well beat 2-0 as well, really.
And then after that, that was it. That was the run.
Yeah, that was it up until, I think my last game was Bashley away, and then we lost to... Did we lose to...
Craig
a week after at Bromley's pitch.
That's exactly why it's relevant, we're talking to Matt Everard the day before a cup game at Bromley.
Bromley.
My brother can't even talk about Bromley. It's like such a painful experience for us. But obviously, going to that run, you know, when we're coming close to that 78, 75 it was, wasn't it? I think we spoke a bit to you and some of the lads at the time because we were kind of connected with the club at the time. And then there was a nervousness about that. Did you feel that at the time as players that, hold on, we're getting closer and closer to this and this is actually quite momentous?
Well, as much as the club had, it kind of did have national media coverage. I mean, the non-league paper had its own Wimbledon edition, which it never used to have before. So we had a lot of coverage anyway, but as the games were coming closer, there was more national coverage of it. So it wasn't, I think it was even in 442. I even think I spoke to someone from the Telegraph now. Like, about it. Like, it's mental, isn't it? And
there's a massive spin. I have the paper somewhere. of the Daily Mirror with the whole team in the dressing room with the when we got the 75.
Then we drew one all. Oh, I can't even think. Where did we draw one
away all? At Bromley?
It was at Bromley. Yeah, and then we lost. Yeah, 2-1.
We love a Wimbledon captain. And one former captain who personifies AFC Wimbledon is Will Nightingale, who celebrated his testimonial year. Will scored our first goal back at Plough Lane after the pandemic in front of a packed Plough Lane. And I also want to take you forwards a little bit, because the one thing that I think we're always really excited about is the fact that to have someone who's come through our ranks, you know, you are one of our own. And we've had the COVID thing. We've gone back to Plough Lane, and the first time that we're all allowed back in the stadium, in our new wonderful stadium, we come up against Bolton, and you scored our first goal at that. What was that like?
Honestly, like even you just saying it, like it does make me a little bit emotional hearing it back. It's there's not really any words that can describe it, because I've basically lived out, you know, the dream, really, you know, like started at the club when I was 8, fan of the club. Obviously, like after everything that had happened, it was almost like I was representing every fan that, you know, I've built relationships with over the years. So it was, yeah, there's not really any words that can describe it. Just a special moment, and almost like something that was written in the stars.
As our club has developed, one of the great successes is our women's team, who are crowned champions of Division 1 Southeast in April. The standout player is super striker Ashley Hinks, who spoke about being a Wimbledon folk hero and how the women's team could develop. At that time, we were doing a little historic cartoon, you know, and we managed to get your picture. So you're immortalised on our cartoon as well. So you're a part of Wimbledon, you know, folklore.
Yeah, I am. And they've got, you know, they've got me in the captain's lounge next to Billy Jones. I do feel incredibly grateful that the love and support that I get from the club. I'd like to think that I've given the service in order to warrant that. You know I take a lot of the plaudits, obviously, naturally I do, because, you know, the status of me coming in, particularly at that time, you know, I'd come straight from the championship as well and dropped to tier 4 for the club. At the time, it was a massive, like, signing for the club. And I suppose specifically because you wouldn't normally have that for your club, not to be disrespectful, but no, that doesn't typically happen. So I think for the club, it was a massive thing. And I think, you know, having come, I think I have elevated the club. But on the back of that, we get better signings, we've progressed through the leagues. Our name is out there in women's football. And sometimes all it takes is, yeah, it's just someone to just shift that momentum within the club. And I'm pleased to have been able to do that, definitely. Yeah.
I totally think it sounds like an investment opportunity that will pay rewards. If you know, so I wouldn't see why we wouldn't want to lobby the club to look to invest more in the women's team, because that will get more people there to those games, etc. It seems like a bit of an easy win scenario, actually, to kind of get some extra revenue. So,
I think catchment area as well. We've got a stadium that can seat 10,000. Perfect women's capacity. There's so many tick boxes to it. You know, if we also progress up the league, you're then able to get loanees from Chelsea, Arsenal, etc., local London teams, London City Lionesses. Now that there's huge opportunities for this club, and you know, that's the reason I'm still here. I'm still trying to be an advocate for what we can achieve. Like, I'm not happy to just be in tier 3 and just plod along, because before you know it, we'll be relegated because all those other teams are taking it more seriously, and that is the worry. And to be totally honest, obviously we've been given the same budget as what we were operating at in tier 4. It's not going to be enough. You know, there's only so much as players we can do until, you know, we need that more investment so we can push and break those boundaries a little bit.
It's great to hear how well the women's team is doing, even though some of us have failed spectacularly to see them play. Watching Wimbledon over the last 40 years or so can seem like an unbelievable film script. In fact, it was a film that almost got made. We caught up with ex-CEO Eric Samuelson, who gave us the lowdown on the project.
A Brit who lived in America to write the script. I think it's from Newcastle. Anyway, from the north of England somewhere. A football fan who loved our story. They found a director, but you basically had the script writer who'd come up with the script. And as I said to you before this started, I got a copy of the last script that we saw. So he was pulling it in one direction. John Green was pulling it in another, and the studio were pulling it in another. And my predictions were right in that the studio was saying, well, there's not enough female interest in here. So they decided to big up the role of a woman in the story. And there's not enough interest for young people. So they wrote a young person into the story. And I was thinking, this is just bollocks. I know I was becoming less and less convinced, but I thought it was going to happen. But then eventually we came to the end of the second option and they chose not to come back and ask again, to my immense relief. It caused a lot of fun because people were talking about who's going to play who. And if you ever want to annoy Ivor, just to say it should have been Danny DeVito. Because used to get to him.
Maybe there will be a film in the future, although we're still waiting for the third installment of the playoff story. As well as harking back to the past, those of us who listened know that we kind of like fan ownership. Perhaps not as much as comedian and super fan Mark Thomas, who joined us back in the summer.
It's the idea that actually you go, no, we're not going to have this. We're going to form our own club. And I was like, that I'm interested in. That I'm interested in. Fan-owned football, I'm interested in. And actually, it's become slightly obsessive, as friends of mine would say, you know, typically so. Like, I love going to see fan-owned football. I really love it. I went to see Clapton. I went to see a game at Whitehawk. Do you know what I mean? I did a fundraiser at Whitehall. I've done one at Clapton. I did one over in... I went to see Clydebank in Scotland. Have you ever been up there?
No.
Oh, man, it's fantastic. The atmosphere is fantastic because it's so rough and ready. The club shop is literally a shipping container, but it's not like a Shoreditch shipping container. It's like someone dragged it off the side of the Clyde with a forklift. Do you know what I mean?
Oh.
And it's so exciting there. And all the ultras are nine. They're all nine. They've all made their own flags. They're all trying to bang it away. And I promise you, this is complete true. One bloke turns up and he starts waving his flag. And his mates are just like, what's that? He said, it's my bed sheet. And you can see the elasticated corners, right? And one of them shouts, does your ma know you've done that? Shut up. And I love that. Do you know what I mean? I love that feeling there. The excitement. The fact that the terrace was just full of mums and toddlers and kids in prams and uncles and somebody who'd snuck in a can and a fag and wasn't looking the right way and gets the ball in the face. Do you know what I mean? All of that kind of stuff is wildly exciting for me. I love that. And that feeling of ownership, the feeling of community
yes.
that you get in those places.
The part of our love of fan ownership comes down to collective PTSD. As Niall said, we're children of the struggle. But part of it is also not wanting to end up fighting again, like the fans of Morecambe and Sheffield Wednesday, who we spoke to at the start of the season. First up is Joel Shooter from Morecambe, followed by Matt Johnson from the Sheffield Wednesday Supporters Trust. Can you just tell us briefly, what is the ownership situation like at the moment? Where are we up to?
So, in terms of just where the position is exactly right at the moment, Jason Wheatham and Bond Group, they're the owners of the club. They've got an offer on the table from a group called Punjab Warriors, who passed the EFL's test at the start of November. And when they did that, our understanding was that it was going to go through the deal. The final deal would go through relatively soon, within the next couple of weeks. That didn't happen. Then we get to the end of June, and basically, all hell breaks loose. It becomes apparent that Jason Wheatham and Bond Group can't pay aren't able to fulfil wage and bill obligations, etc. Punjab have actually been doing that for the past year anyway. They've been supporting the club, and as far as we're aware, Jason and Bond Group aren't really able to do that. But despite being at this point, they for whatever reason won't sign over the final sale of the club. Despite the fact that they can't fund it themselves, and understandably Punjab aren't going to put any more money in until the deal gets done. At one point, Jason, early July, said he was definitely going to sell. He was going to sell to Punjab over the weekend. Then come Monday, that didn't happen. He reneges on that again, and we're left in this situation where he's toted another buyer on the scene. We're dubious about the actual existence of that buyer, let alone whether they'd be fit and proper. And yeah, we're now at a point where players are leaving, things are shutting down around the club, academies sort of stopped operations, most things around the club have stopped operations.
Got a lot of creditors of the football club, you know, local businesses that are owed money. There's this, you know, they weirdly introduced facial recognition and a new CCTV scheme in February, all at the same time they weren't investing in the North Stand. There's a whole host of decisions that defy belief, to be honest. So it can feel quite pressurised, but we've got a lot of support from local and national politicians. Other fan bases, including your own, have been absolutely fantastic with us. And that really gets people through, I think, because it's, you know, you've been through similar situations and you do need the support of your fellow fans just to make you feel relatively normal from time to time, because there are some significant pressures that come onto people and some people can cope better than others with that. So there's a lot happening. And yesterday we had the big protest, which we stayed out of the ground for 5 minutes and then came in afterwards. Which was a big success. Leicester City, as a football club, were absolutely phenomenal. The way they stewarded and helped us to do that, the way they understood it, it was great. We're not used to that because our club doesn't engage with the fans. I mean, they said that they hated us. I'm sure they don't. It just feels that way sometimes. Sky Sports were amazing. The Leicester City fans, yeah, it was pretty emotional when the fans came in and they all started applauding. You just don't expect that. And yeah, it's been a bit of a tough old few months, and I think it's going to get tougher. As you guys know, there's it gets a lot worse before it gets a lot better. So
the good news is that Morecambe now have new owners, and hopefully Sheffield Wednesday will have one soon. The bad news is that Sheffield Wednesday's new owner could be Mike Ashley, and Morecambe currently lie 22nd in the National League. But it's early days. Now, we know the Don's Trust board might not be perfect, but those who sit on it do an amazing job and are our elected representatives. We've often spoken about the changes we'd like to see, but also keen to hear what other people think. In November, we invited on Daniel Brett, who gave his take on why younger fans support the club.
We're children of the struggle, if you like.
Yeah.
That's where we were. We were right at that start. But like now that new generation, how much does the fan ownership make it? How important is that? And what makes... What appeals to that fan base? Why have we got 8,000 home fans now? What's making us feeling that unique?
From I know this is probably a bit of a echo chamber with Nazi Twitter being as it is, but what I can gather from younger fans, younger than myself, isn't fan ownership. I don't think that's the most important thing. It's a great thing for them to have. I think it's more success with how well we've been doing over the last few years and community, that we're just community orientated. I think those are the main things that appeal to a younger fan base.
Representation on the board has been an ongoing issue, one that we know the DTB are keen to address. We spoke to Kay McQueenie from Wowzer about the experience of Wimbledon accountant in the South Stand and the reason why some women might not stand for the board.
Being a role model, that makes a huge impact. But there is one thing that came to light, has come to light a few times recently, is that as an older woman who's been coming to football for, you know, well over 20 years, you know, we've had positive experiences coming to football, but actually the younger generation are not having the same experience, and that's really sad.
What's going on, Kerry? Why do you think the younger generation? I mean, I'm excited. My 14-year-old daughter comes to football at the moment. I think she enjoys it, but I'm getting, when it's a sort of like that, slightly older, maybe coming on their own or coming with mates, and you're talking 16, 25, that sort of thing. What's the experience?
So, I mean, it's not going to be the same experience for everyone,
no,
but
of course.
We've had people say that people question why they're in the South Stand, what they're doing in there. Do they really have a place in there? Making them feel like they don't have a place in there, that they're not comfortable being there. And that's not right. because everyone's welcome at football. Everyone has a place there. Everyone.
Hang on. Women are not welcome in the South Stand.
Of a certain age. I feel unwelcome in the South Stand.
Oh my word! That I'm really sad to hear that. Genuinely,
my daughter Amelia, who goes when she's not travelling, what she's doing at the moment, she actually really likes being in the South Stand because she loves the kind of noise and the atmosphere. Though she has mentioned some of the things that Kerry mentions, which there are certain times where it's felt a little bit, you know, uncomfortable. But when she goes with her friends and she's not sitting with us lot, the same old Wombles, she does like being in the South Stand because she likes the kind of atmosphere and the songs and all the rest of it. But I think when it goes wrong, or when we're in a bad run, then you will get, GSAD, that experience of probably kind of like microaggressions, that sexism that exists as a kind of moment when we're not winning.
Kerry,
it might be worse
you,
than that, Kerry. I mean, that's just me recounting the story of one girl.
Yeah.
And I think that it's easy for us to say, oh, it's a really safe place and it's not our experience. But we have to listen and have those difficult conversations with those younger fans and find out actually what is going on there. And I don't have any of the answers, but all I would say is call on every male that attends matches that if you spot something that might meant to be funny, but if it's looking like it's making someone feel uncomfortable, call it out, because it builds that sort of thing. It builds and later. Personally, I wouldn't stand. I don't have the time to dedicate to it. I've got a young family, which is a shame that would be a barrier for someone.
Yeah.
I do think you'd have to be. I think anyone who stands for the Don's Trust Board is phenomenal because they're opening themselves up for a lot of abuse, and that's sad because obviously anyone who stands for the board is just there to do their best for what they believe is right for the club.
Yep.
But online, I think it's quite toxic, and I don't think I would be strong enough to put myself in that position.
We also caught up with Xavier Wiggins, freshly back from his mammoth walk, visiting wonderful community projects run through football club foundations, which inspired him to think of some innovative and exciting ideas for our club.
And I've started compiling a list of what a brilliant community club might look like, right? And there are some really simple things community appearances. The average number of player appearances in communities in the EFL was 292, right? So clearly one metric might be, right, well, how many appearances? But it also might be what share of your marketing voice is devoted to talking about community stuff? How closely do you represent your community? You know, if you've got a high BAME population in your area and you've got all white boards, you're not representing really the people from your community. There could be all sorts of things. And actually, I'd really like to just sit down with each club because it'll all be different, and talk to their various stakeholders and look at what brilliant community club looks like. And in our case, I've said it before, but I don't believe we can plausibly build a plan for the championship. I don't believe we can plausibly build a plan for any kind of, you know, we could spend the rest of my life without another promotion, realistically, right? But I absolutely believe that we could build a 3-year plan to be the best community club in the country. And I think more, and perhaps more radically than that, is we're going to be a non-profit anyway. So let's look at the structure. Could the club be a CIC? If the club is a CIC and goes B Corp, and places impact above everything else, then suddenly you've got an opportunity to attract completely different money, right?
This is totally speaking our language.
There are
people.
As you'll know, this money. Is totally what I totally advocate for all of that.
Yeah,
massively. Sav, so. And yeah, Sav. I'm going to point it.
Sav, yeah, carry on, mate.
No. So there are good people giving giving, you know, with family trusts or businesses or foundations or whatever, there are good groups giving significant money to organizations that deliver impact, and they you know, family trust, they will say, right, we focus, for example, on youth development, right, and people with barriers to employment, right, and then within their terms, it says that, you know, when they put a pound in, they want to see £8 back, right? Well, guess what, they could do that through football, because football can deliver that impact because the badge is so powerful. So once you know, is the path to survival in League One when there's 5 million average losses, and that's going to go to 7 or 8 even with the regulator, let's face it, in 3 or 4 years time, is the path just to keep getting the name on a stand for 40 grand? I don't think that's a sustainable approach to football.
We know that the DTB and club keen to listen to us, and hope you're taking note of what Kerry, Daniel and Zav have spoken about. One way we know the club listens is because when we suggested the board be available to speak to prospective candidates, they set up a session for those people looking to stand. The other is when we spoke about the management at Oggs extending their contracts. Before you know it, it had happened. We're still getting them, we're still waiting to hear back whether Joe Lewis extends his contract. Having brilliant fans doing great work is what we're all about. Whether that's the Whopper team doing the brilliant Batsford Boys dinner, Wish celebrating our heritage and maintaining our wonderful museum, DLAG and the foundation working in the community, or fans raising money for the squad, fans like Jude Turner working on the We Are Wimbledon Fund.
But, you know, it's a group of us who are just, you know, fans trying to fit it around all our work commitments and everything else. And we literally have a WhatsApp group where we're like, what can we do now? And then we pretty much just then do it immediately. It's all quite fast paced, isn't it, Adam? Usually Duke has an idea and we all either give him a thumbs up or you're mental or not doing that. And then we just kind of go for it. So there's been a few sort of, there's been a bit of kickback like there is always when anyone asks for money for the club. You know, we wouldn't have to do that if we had a billionaire owner, etc. But we're not moaning, we're doing something about it. So, you know, take from that, you know, what you will. I'm very much in the, and I know Adam is too, of the, I'd rather go back to sitting on hay bales and having a lovely club that we own than taking money from any owner coming in again, ever. And I know that isn't always a very popular opinion. So that's partly reason why I wanted to get involved was, well, let's just try and help and do what we can. I don't know what our figure is at the moment. Can you remember, Adam? I'm useless with numbers.
I know. I'm going to look it up.
I'm trying to think. I'm the one who did the bloody graphic for it. I think we're on 19,500.
I was going to say it's nearly 20, I'm sure.
Yeah. And we haven't had an update for a few weeks. So, yeah, I think, yeah, so around 20 grand is what we've got so far.
You can still donate for the We Are Wimbledon Fund at wearewimbledonfund.com. Naturally, the biggest funding effort this year was undertaken by Zav and his Walk 92, well, 91. Here he is again talking about how he came up with the idea and the planning that was put in place. When did that idea come about?
So I was never going to be the one walking. A mate of mine, Simon, lives in Wimbledon, but he's actually an Arsenal fan. He came up with the idea of Walk 92, and we had somebody with lived experience of homelessness who was going to walk it. So he'd come through homelessness, he'd become a football coach, had worked with the Street Soccer Foundation who tackle youth homelessness. And honestly, we felt we had a real duty of care to him, and we didn't feel that, you know, it's a very demanding thing, and we didn't feel that he was going to be able to do it. So that suddenly meant that we needed to go and find somebody. And I thought, well, I can't be bothered doing that. That's going to take ages finding someone stupid enough to walk 92 grounds in 92 days. So I just thought I'll do it. So, I had a chat with my wife, came up with about 200 reasons not to do it, and then ignored them all, and then set about trying to get a route. So Simon found randomly a Canadian mapping software company called Safe, spoke to them. They did the kind of the initial route. I've actually got a T-shirt in my cupboard that says 3,250 miles, 35 miles a day. I believe that is physically impossible, having experienced 23 miles a day. But that was our opening gambit on distance.
Whoosh.
And then we mixed it in with some AI, then some Google Maps, and then about 15, 20 hours of conversations between three of us. And we arrived at a route that was... that seemed more reasonable. It seemed like a couple of thousand miles. And then each day, basically, like often I'd just leave the hotel, I'd stick my Google Maps on, and I'd head in the direction it was telling me to do. And if I got to a hideous road and there was anything like an alternative, I'd do the alternative, as long as it didn't add on too much time. But I guess the big thing that I hadn't predicted was how many horrible roads there were going to be, where I was just literally walking in the road. It was like being in a computer game with kind of juggernauts coming towards me and jumping onto the verge. I pictured the creation of this video game, by the way, because I think I've lived it. So yeah, it's pretty bonkers. But the mapping took a long time, and we didn't get it right. I don't think there's a perfect way of doing it, but we got it as good as we could.
So there was a lot of walking along A roads when you were doing this.
There was so much. I've actually got a really good film. I hadn't in all of my kind of updates. I was very aware that my mum was watching this, and I really didn't want her sitting on the edge of her seat for 92 days, wondering whether I'd be alive for our next update in the evening. So I didn't shout overly about how bad it was. But anyway, yeah, my mate, who's a journalist, he couldn't help himself. So we were walking together, and he was pretty blown away by the sort of conditions we were walking in. And he's got a really good film that shows how brutal it was. But clearly there were some beautiful walks, but there were a lot of really bad ones. And it's not just A roads, it can be B roads, but with when you've got no paths, if I had the big rucksack, which was my kind of 10-kilo rucksack, which more often than not was taken from A to B for me, which was nice, but if you got the perfect storm of that, rubbish roads and crappy weather, then that wasn't really a good day. But you can't, you know, you just got to get on with it. But it was, it was mad trying to organise the route.
You can also hear our full interview with Zav in season 4, episode 14. It is well worth a listen, and an amazing achievement. We'd also like to give special shout out to Andrew Foster, who we spoke to at the start of the season, about his work with the London Broncos to support Amelia's big day out, raising money for stem cell research. We know things might seem a bit doom and gloom on the pitch as we head towards the end of the year, but there are exciting plans ahead. As we heard from Angus Fox, chair of the Dons Trust board, who took some time out to explain about fan ownership and future investment. So do you kind of think that we can continue into the future as a fan-owned club? And I guess, if so, how do we go about attracting the investment that we need to continue being fan-owned?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, absolutely do. Fan ownership is completely fundamental to me. And I think it is to the rest of the board as well. And it's part of our DNA from where we've come from. So it'd be a very brave Don's Trust board that stood up and said, we're not going to be fan owned anymore. And that isn't something that's on my list of things to do. So then if that's the case, right, if that's where you've got to be, what does that mean that you can do in terms of getting investors and getting finance and money into the club? Well, you have to find a partner to invest in the club who gets that, who gets fan ownership, who somehow gets that being fan owned brings you more as an investment than it takes away. Now, some investors won't do that. Some investors come and talk to us and say, we'd have to buy the whole thing. And that's, it's a very short conversation, right? Because they're not the investors for us. But we are absolutely sure that we can find and work with investors who get us, who get what we're trying to do, and who can help us. And the way that they can help us is by investing in us and growing with us and putting working capital into our club to help us to be successful. And that, you know, that's what we're spending time trying to bring about, an investment like that with a group of people who can get who we are and why they would want to invest in fan-owned clubs and get the value of Wimbledon and take us with them on a journey further.
And you feel that we've got there are investors kind of that you've got in mind, or people you're talking to?
We're in really active conversations with numerous different groups, which is so interesting.
Cool.
And I can't, you know, no. Don't ask because I can't tell you.
That's fine. No, we're just interested that it's happening.
But there are numerous, you know, a handful of different investment groups. Football's really interesting to people at the moment. And our story is really interesting to people. Our location is really interesting to people. Our focus on community is really interesting to people. Our fantastic stadium and its capability to draw crowds is really interesting to people. The opportunity to help us develop that to its full potential in terms of the number of seats we could have there and additional opportunities for, you know, property improvements in that stadium is really interesting to people. Yeah, of course, not everyone is going to have all of the things that we want. But we have a handful of people that we're talking to who all exhibit all of the things that we have been talking about, who get that we are bringing a big piece of ourselves to this investment opportunity, and they have to bring a big piece of themselves to it. We have a track record of revenue every year. We have our audiences in the leagues. We have our fantastic stadium. That's our piece. We have our community focus and we have our fan ownership model. They have expertise, let's say, in real estate development, perhaps, or in stadium development, and they have working capital, and they have an understanding that in order to grow our club, we have to grow our academy, and we have to grow our ability to develop players, and we have to grow the stadium side that we're on. So, you know, yeah, we're talking. I mean, I can't tell you how many people are involved in it. There's two boards full of people, and then there's a whole group of people around the working groups in the fundraising and finance committees who are adjuncts to that, who are helping us to construct discussion documents and organize meetings and for us to do those things. And it's really, really active. It's not something we're thinking about doing. It's something we're all involved in. Every day, perhaps every couple of days, certainly every week, talking to these folks and moving the conversations forward and trying to get us to a place where we think we can land one of these investors that's compatible with us and can help us move forward the way we want to.
So we can go into the new year with a little bit of hope and we can reflect on a job well done. So let's end with the biggest moment from 2025, our promotion back to League One. Our away win at Grimsby guaranteed a playoff spot, with the winner being scored by Sam Hutchinson, who suffered a mild heart attack prior to knocking the ball in. It was a moment that we started to believe. I mean, really believe. Oh, come on, mate. Let's remember that we are the It's Time to Believe club.
This is where we are now.
70 points. The second highest points tally since we got back into the league in 2011.
We've worked so hard to get a team, get a league place and get a stadium.
Our stadium.
This season, we are so close.
Beaten Ipswich.
We've taken Newcastle virtually all the way.
And smashed the franchise.
We have done all of this as a fans-owned club.
To the team.
You know how hard we've fought.
On the pitch, you are our representatives.
You embody us as a club.
Now is not the time to be downhearted. It's the time to believe.
It's time to believe.
It's time to believe.
It's time to believe.
It is time to believe.
Time to believe!
It is time to believe.
It is time to believe.
It's time to believe.
It's time to believe.
It's time to believe.
It's time to believe.
And thanks to all those who contributed to our little video. That was brilliant. The only issue I had with promotion was the promise I made to my daughter to get a tattoo. Unfortunately, I mentioned this to Mark Thomas at the time.
No.
And I've still not got that tattoo.
Yeah, oh, Matt. What tattoo are you going to get? Tell me.
Well, see what's
Matt,
happened.
Matt was... Go on, Matt.
I had this thing. Because my daughter's been coming along. She's had a season ticket. Although she's 14, so she's stopped now because she's got other things to be doing on a Saturday afternoon, apparently. But she said, Dad, if we get a trophy, you've got to get a tattoo. And I was just like, yeah, because in my mind, when I'm thinking trophy, I'm thinking like, you know, the FA Cup or, you know, the EFL trophy or something like that. I don't know. But anyhow, so we got a trophy. So now I've got to get a tattoo. And already I feel sore already thinking about it.
What is the tattoo you're going to get?
I'm trying to work it out because the flag seems quite involved to me. That seems like quite a big thing.
Badge. Can I make a suggestion?
Yeah, please.
Because I love tattoos. And I've been contemplating one for a while, which is on the shoulder.
Yeah, yeah.
Vinnie Jones gathered.
So let us to that great day at Wembley on the 26th of May. And my chance to make an addition to the excellent On This Day book by Gary Jordan and Stephen Crabtree, which we quote at the start of each show. Here's the On This Day after that famous victory. Adam actually slept. Look at him. What, mate?
Jesus Christ.
I know.
I'm blooming knackered.
In this week, against the odds, AFC Wimbledon booked their place in League One with a super strike by midfield wonder Miles Hippolyte. Led by Super Johnny Jackson, the team of Goodman, Johnson, Lewis, Harbottle, Tilly, Nerfell, Smith, Reeves, Hippolyte, Brown and Stevens, with substitute support from Oggs, Kelly, Maycock and Sasu, beat Walsall at Wembley in front of 28,000 delirious Wimbledon fans to secure promotion back to League One. We are the same old Wombles and we are going up. So we are going. We ended the season with our annual awards, some of which are unfortunately still sitting in my house. Listen in here as we present our Harry Pell Award for Best Off-Field AFC Wimbledon Moment and the Mandy Award for Club Person. The latter was a truly beautiful moment. We also announced our winners of the Sort It Out Jackson Award for Best Sub and Who Ate All the Pies Award for Best Food Outlet.
The Harry Pell Award is...
Graham Stacey! Many congratulations. Thank you. Many congratulations.
Thank you. Cheers.
You're welcome. Have a look.
I didn't really do anything, so thank you. Oh, I didn't kick a ball at any franchise fans or anything, so... No, but next year I'll kick a ball at the Frannies. But, bloody hell.
Yeah, don't drop it.
Oh, gosh.
This is a real award. Really for you. Buddy, how are you doing?
I'm good, how are you?
Very well. We're from the same old Wombles podcast. So we're doing a little podcast. We're doing a little vote amongst ourselves because we have this best club person of the year award. And it's called the Mandy Award. And this year, you are the recipient of the... Yeah, so our club person of the year.
That is amazing. Thank you guys so much. Oh,
Oh my god, I was not expecting that.
There you are.
Oh my god, thank you. Honestly, that is amazing.
Well, we've heard all about everything you've done and all this, the work you've done with the foundation, so it's so amazing. So we're
honestly, that is, I don't even know what I'm speaking to. I was not expecting that at all. I thought you were just going to be like, oh, can you see if you can give us a ball or something?
There you go.
That is amazing. Oh, I'm going to love that. I'm going to use it for my hot chocolate.
There you are. Yeah, and here's a box to keep it safe in. So, you're amazing. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. Like, honestly, this club wouldn't work if we all didn't put our, like, 2 pence in, you know? So it's all of us that collectively do it.
But, I know. But,
oh, my God, that is amazing. But, look,
people need a little bit of attention. So there you are. Thank you so much.
I appreciate that so much. Thank you.
You're more than welcome.
Thank you so much.
Awesome.
Hopefully we'll get to see the trophy. Fingers crossed. If not, I'll see you out there.
Cool. Take it properly at hopefully our first home match of the next season. But we're going to announce them now. And this is the Sort It Out Jackson Award for Best Sub. And the winner was, it's not going to surprise anyone, Callum Maycock, for coming on and scoring 2 goals in 20 minutes against the franchise. Fantastic work, Callum. And our last prize is the Who Ate All the Pies Award for Best Food Outlet. And the winner this year is My Pie. Before we go, just want to say a special thanks to all the guests we've had on this year. Tristan Garcia, Mikey T, Barry James, Steve Mumford, Kerry McQueenie, Philo, John Scales, Eric Samuelson, Will Nightingale, Graham Stacey, Mark Thomas, Ashley Hinks, Joel Shooter, Matt Johnson, Ann Pugh, Joe Blair, Mickey Haswell, Danny Brett, Xavier Wiggins, Matt Everard, Angus Fox, Jude Turner and Andrew Foster. Despite all these brilliant interviews, there's always been one person that's eluded us, although we've got close a couple of times.
Tell us about your guaranteed upcoming celeb guest.
Friend of the show.
Chatting to Les driving instructor guy, he said to me he'd just been wandering down the carriage, and he ran into John Green. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know John was at the game. Turns out he was at the game, and it was mentioned on other socials elsewhere, but I didn't see it. He said, yeah, he'd run into John Green. John Green was going to sponsor him in aid of the foundation, blah, 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 blah. So that's nice. We keep talking about John Green coming on the podcast, but he never does. And about 5 minutes later, John Green walks down the carriage. And at this point, John Green, we didn't know this, was busting to go to the loo. But of course, John Green being John Green, stops to talk to everybody and then doesn't actually tell anyone politely that he's busting to go to the loo until we've regaled him for 10 minutes along the lines of, John, can I ask you a question? Yes, of course you can. Okay, right. Well, I'm part of the Same Old Wombles podcast. Do you know about us? Yes, we do. Okay, that's great. Do you listen to NS? Yes, I do. I listen to all of them, including Same Old Wombles. It's like, thank you very much, John. Yeah, great. So shout out to John Green. Then I say, John, we need to get you on as a guest because there's a running joke, but you don't ever come on as a guest, and you said you would, and you haven't done so. So what's going on? And I said, we tried to hit you up on socials, and he just looks at me as if to say, everybody hits me up on socials, so I'm never going to respond to that. But then he said he's coming back over again in November, so he should be able to sort something out when he's next back over. And some of the other people in the consortium that have put the money in are coming with him as well.
Oh, so, do you know what, Mark? I guess get tired of him all the time contacting us. When can I be on the show? What's going on?
I don't think we need to understand.
It's just like, John, whoa, mate, give us a rest. There are other people out there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, we had him booked in, but we had to have the Mark Lewis special. We're talking about the Plymouth trip. So, because of that,
we've cancelled him.
We had someone else booked in for tonight, but they let us down as well. So.
As usual, it's been a rollercoaster year for the club, and we've been here throughout. And we'll be there in 2026, no matter whatever happens. Have a wonderful new year. We're the Same Old Wombles. We're back.
I've been standing here since many years ago. You've been under my skin for as long as I have known. Traveled away and we stand in the rain and the cold. Take the rough with the smooth.